This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, everybody, we're going to get started now. So first off, thanks so much to all of you for coming, which is the first formal book launch and preview for Abolish Rent. I am really happy and proud to be sharing this book with you guys. The co-authors, Tracy Rosenthal and Leonardo Vilches, are really brilliant, as I think you'll hear throughout the course of the panel. And if you like what you hear, I would really encourage you to pick up a copy in the book room. I think it's $10, $12. An affordable book, and there are opportunities to buy bulk copies, really cheap discounts for your organization if that's relevant to you. As I said, this is a really cool opportunity for us to kind of preview what I think is quite a special book. I want to say a bit about the authors, say a bit about the book, and then really hand it off to them to be able to talk. You know, Tracy is a co-founder of the LA Tenants Union, a frequent contributor to the New Republic, a co-author of this book, and they are now on rent strike in New York City. I helped build other tenant organizations in New York City with Tracy over the last few years. They are a deeply committed, very thoughtful, endlessly generous with their time. I am really glad that they are going to get to speak to you today. Leonardo has been organizing tenants in Boyle Heights for more than 30 years. Trained in liberation theology, he co-founded Union de Vecinos in 1996 and the LA Tenants Union in 2015. Leo is also the author of Abolish Rent and is one of my personal heroes, someone who I've learned so much from, kind of following this book from different stages of its development. In order to get, you know, this book is, I think, without exaggeration, one of the most important books to be published in English in the United States in the last few years. And I want to say a couple reasons why. It's a really highly original, brilliant account of one of the primary kind of, you know, modalities of how we experience the crisis in the United States today. It gives a socialist perspective into the housing crisis, a real accounting of one of the primary drivers of inequality that we experience today, one of the primary expressions of exploitation and dispossession as it unfolds in our personal lives and in our bank accounts, but also roils the cities where we live, where we work, where we make a home. It's also a really compelling kind of rewriting of the last century of politics in America to put tenants back at the center of that story, of the shifting kind of blocks, the landlord, real estate block, their alliance with the state, which has remade public policy in a range of domains and has remade what it means to be working class in this country. The authors take seriously the idea from Frederick Jameson, who insisted that in our time, all politics is about real estate. They've turned that insight into a real toolkit for how we can make sense of what's going on in this country and elsewhere in the world to make sense of the last 100 years of the war on tenants. Maybe most importantly, though, you know, our authors, they really record and reflect a tremendously important thing that's happening in this country, which is this almost subterranean current of working class organization, which is rarely recorded, rarely reflected in the mainstream press, is rarely kind of registers as more than a blip when people talk about what the housing crisis is. But they really tell these incredibly compelling stories of tenants who are turning to themselves, turning to their neighbors, fighting back, winning, and in the course of that, remaking our cities. So for all of that, I think it's a really remarkable and highly original book. I do hope you read it. I am going to ask them some questions, but first, I want to ask you some questions. So can I get a raise of hands? How many people in this room are tenants themselves? Sizable number, that's not surprising. How many of you have ever had to pick a fight with your landlord before in the course of being a tenant? Yeah, hands are up. How many of you are part of a tenants union, an association, or tenants organization? That is really cool to see all those hands go up. Last question, how many of you are paying too much in rent? Yeah, an even larger number. So we can close that gap between people who have started picking fights with their landlords and those who are on, who are just tenants. So Tracy and Leonardo, let's get into it. This book is so obviously an effort to organize the kind of accumulated wisdom and intelligence of the tenant movement up until this point. But we should start by saying a little probably about what the tenant movement is, how it started, and I guess like in particular, what the Los Angeles Tenant Union is. Why, you know, this kind of effort to organize tenants as tenants has taken the form of a tenants union, and how it got up to the point where it is today.
Can I get this out? Okay, phew. Well, first, thank you for that introduction. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's really amazing to see everyone out and to know that all of you are already bad tenants. I just to plug the Los Angeles Tenant Union is going to have a panel tomorrow at noon, which will be, in their own words, sort of an exploration of what strategies and tactics are being practiced in LA. And we have with us like one of the tenants whose story we tell in the book, so you can hear that like in her own words tomorrow. So I just really like want to invite everyone who's here today to also be there with us tomorrow. But just maybe to frame a little bit about our union in terms of our own development, right? Like the first activity that we ever did as a group before really we were a union was a renter's rights workshop. And there's like, and eventually what we realized was that like all three parts of that framework had to go. Renters, because people who pay rent aren't the only people who like live in opposition to our capitalist housing system. Those people include people who live outside, people who are incarcerated, people who are in care homes. Like renting wasn't necessarily the operative dynamic. Rights, because you know the ones we already have don't mean we can use them. It doesn't mean that landlords. There's so many up front if y'all want.
Yeah, there's a ton of chairs up here, folks, so come on up.
Please come in. And we realized, you know, like rights aren't how we're going to get a different kind of world, a world where housing is a human right. And in that framework, that suggests a different kind of world. And then also workshop, right? Because we didn't just want to give people tools to fight their struggle as individuals and then send them on their way. So through this process, what we landed upon is the formation of a tenant union. In our organization, we define tenant as anyone who doesn't control their own housing. And that, as I said, includes people who live outside, people who are incarcerated, people who are in care homes, tenant as a, like thinking through tenant as a political subject has been really important to our work. And then a tenant union, right, became that vehicle. It's the means we have to take collective control over where and how we live. So not just about repairing our, it's not just about our living conditions, right? It's about our lives. It's about exercising control over you know the thing that makes it possible for all of the other forms of relationships that we have, everything else that is determined by where we live and who our communities are, and then just to give some context, right, about like the revolutionary potential of that form of organization and tenants as a political subject in a time when capital is reorganizing itself around speculation, around the reordering of urban place. And that is, you know, right now, 65% of the world's wealth is held in real estate, and 75% of that is in housing. So I think that, you know, this really names for us what it means for tenants to participate in the anti-capitalist project and the communist project of redistributing that hoard, of that project of taking control over where we live is part of that broader effort to reclaim property. And I'm going to let Leo give a little bit more of a story of our history.
Well, just also very important why you should go to the presentation tomorrow is because you're going to hear the stories of two different locals. And my stories mostly come from our local, which is the Los Angeles, the Union de Vecinos Eastside local in Boyle Heights. And here you have South Central and K-Town, Koreatown. So if you, the tenants union is a diverse community of communities that covers the whole city, and every part of the city has a different reality. We're in the richest state, in the largest city, with our friendliest party, the friend of the working class, the friend of the of African Americans, a friend of migrants, the Democratic Party. So you know it's great how we live in there. The tenants union was formed out of two different stories. On the side of the Unión de Vecinos Eastside local, we started in 1996 fighting against the demolition of housing project. 1,100 families that for a long time have learned to deal with the issues that they were confronting with, like anti-immigration raids, gang violence, poor housing conditions from the part of the housing authority. They had been organizing for about 10 years to be able to address all these problems. And there's lots of stories of how they were able to confront these issues. But the community decided to organize against that demolition. So the 1,100 families came together around an organization, a non-profit organization in the local community that said, we want to fight against the demolition of our housing. And the nonprofit said, no, we support the demolition of the housing project. It's going to be a better life for you. It's going to be a better life for everybody. It's going to bring nonprofit housing. We went to the affordable housing developers, and they said, no, this is good. The state cannot do what we can do, so we should allow for the demolition of the housing projects. And so on and so forth. We went down the list, and the residents decided, in spite of everything, to fight against the demolition of the housing. Needless to say, nonprofits, the LA Times, the church, and everybody and their grandmother intervened in this struggle. Pretty much divided the community, and the fight was between those who wanted a better future by allowing for the demolition of the housing and those who were putting at risk their families and their homes. Needless to say that the half who decided to allow for this to happen are no longer living in the housing projects. Everybody who decided to fight this stayed in the housing projects. We didn't win the battle. We got housing for only 500 families, but it is in that defeat that our union was born. It is in that defeat of residents trying to get out of the box and fight from a different perspective that tenants union was, that our local was born. After that, as we were working with people who live in the other neighborhoods, we started realizing that people live in very bad housing. And nonprofits and CDCs and developers and everybody and their grandmother said, affordable housing is the way. And we went behind those campaigns, fighting, mobilizing our community to do this thing. And every time that a new development would come, they would say, well, you know, your members don't qualify. They don't have the income. They have a criminal record. They don't have the credit, so on and so forth. And on top of that, there is only a tiny few of those. So here we are again, the nonprofit industrial sectors supporting the demolition of housing and then not building the housing that is necessary. We went on and we started fighting against the conditions of housing, the slumlord conditions of housing. And because we were part of the nonprofit industrial sector, we were like, you know, let's go to organizations and ask for formulating and building a tenants union. And the foundation said, well, we don't have the funding. We have to do the research. The nonprofit organizations were saying, it's too risky right now under these kind of policies that we have around building an alternative, which is affordable housing, and that we just don't have time to do this. So Unión de Vecinos kept marching along, trying to figure out what to do in their own neighborhood, fighting slumlords, fighting evictions, and figuring out what to do. On the other side, members of Unión de Vecinos were part of an art group called Ultra Red. And Ultra Red was trying to explore the conditions of the current conditions, political and social conditions. And we were doing a lot of exploration around neoliberal conditions, you know, the displacement of people, privatization, so on and so forth. And we reached a limit, right? Going to talk to artists about neoliberalism is really cool, feels really cool, but nothing happens. We just come out feeling really good about our presentations. So we decided to really localize our struggle in Los Angeles. And we formed this thing called the School of Echoes. And the School of Echoes was circles of reflection throughout the city of activists and organizers and regular people who were not part of the nonprofit industrial complex, but that care about what was happening in their communities. As we came together, we realized that the most important thing, and gentrification was coming our way, the most important thing was to fight gentrification. And the logic was we had to form a tenants union. So one day we're in a meeting in the room trying to figure out what the fuck to do and saying, how do we start a tenants union? And then I started having nightmares. Oh, here we go again. People are going to think about it. But Tracy luckily said, here's my $5. I'm the first member. So we have here member 001 of the Los Angeles Tenants Union. Here is the present time. Our first campaign, apart from the workshops, is a rent strike. We had a campaign first around Ellis Building. So basically, because of rent control or because of the politics of Los Angeles, the only way a landlord could get rid of tenants was by doing with this thing called the Ellis policy, which basically the landlord says, I'm no longer going to rent housing and everybody has to go. We fought and fought. We got an extension of 2 years for the tenants there. Eventually, they moved out. Another defeat, but that makes us stronger. And the following year, or 2 years later on, we had the rent strike, which Tracy is going to talk about. But basically, that's when we started launching the tenants union. Successful struggles led by the tenants outside of the nonprofit industrial complex, separated and independent from the country, from the government, and really led by a more organized movement of people who didn't have in their head that there is only one way of doing things.
Okay, that's a really powerful note. And I wanted to pick up on what you just ended off there with, which is, you know, the book is organized around the insights of tenants in struggle, their stories, their analysis, their practice. There are often stories that come from, you know, fights that you've been involved with rather intensely. And so the text, it's much richer, much more textured than manifestos typically are. You guys write with a really kind of inspiring voice, but it's a multi-voice kind of project. So I wanted to ask you to tell an evocative story from the book, an evocative fight, like story that, you know, feels expressive of the kind of fights that the tenant union in LA gets involved in.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Leo. I'm embarrassed, but I appreciate it. I'm going to talk about, you know, the story that we make a chapter of in our book because it was one of the foundational struggles, and we think in advance in terms of the movement strategy and tactics, and that is the mariachi rent strike. And this was a building of 26 units in Boyle Heights in a non-rent control building in a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood where all of the tenants basically had a target on their backs. And a new landlord purchased their building in 2015 they renamed it Mariachi Crossing after Mariachi Plaza, which was one block away. And obviously, like, the irony was not lost on the tenants, right? That, like, the history of the neighborhood was being leveraged against, like, the very tenants who were its present. And the, you know, a third of the building was made of mariachi musicians who relied on the access to Mariachi Plaza to get to work. So to lose their housing would also mean to lose their jobs. And to, like, lose their, you know, and every tenant in the building had a connection to their community, children in neighborhood schools, women who, like, relied on selling goods in the square. Like, all of these, everyone has a claim over the place where they live. And when the landlord decided to increase rents, in some cases, almost like $800 a month, right? These were like completely unaffordable increases. The tenants association was formed in the East Side local of the Los Angeles Tenant Union. And their campaign that lasted, that is ongoing, they continue to organize, but that campaign, began in a series of actions that were, starting with a really modest goal. Like, we just want a meeting. We just want to show you our faces. And we want to show you our faces, and we want you to have to face the people that you are, like, evicting, not only from this building, but from the neighborhood. And the landlord's, refusal and intransigence really led to our union's first rent strike. And this was a rent strike really importantly, both of tenants who couldn't pay the increases and tenants who could, right, who out of solidarity with their neighbors decided to withhold all of their rent. So not just the rent that they couldn't pay, but the whole damn thing. And part of that process I think that there's like a few key lessons that we try to draw out, and I'll just name a couple of them, right? And like in terms of how you organize a rent strike, how you escalate, and what that strategy of a rent strike actually tells us about the horizon of the tenant struggle. And so like first, you know, like there was a one-on-one blitz to get support for people to join the strike in solidarity. But I think one of the more stunning moments is when we talk to the tenants, when we talk to Issa in particular, you know, all of the tenants ended up signing this like rent strike pact. And I think as organizers, we're often like looking at like, what are the tools that we can use to bring people on board? And they signed a rent strike pact. So in my mind, I'm thinking, great, like rent strike pact, check. But Issa didn't remember signing that letter. What she remembers is that finally she felt comfortable being able to borrow an onion from her neighbor. And that to me really sort of made it clear that, like, you know, in terms of building a movement, what we're doing is building relationships and we're building community. And that community that we make by defending it, right? Like that is the material of our struggle. Second, right, in terms of tactics of escalation, one of the things that the tenants and like the tenant union did was camp out in front of the landlord's house. And I think, you know, this lesson that eviction displacement is personal for us, and it should be personal for our landlords too. And that kind of taking the struggle to the landlord's door was a really important lesson for us in how we advanced our strategy. And third, right, you know, I think it comes in this like new forms of relationships to each other and to the places that we live that we can really only access when we take a risk, like when we take a political risk. And I think that, you know, it's so funny from, you know, tenants who went from being terrified that if they didn't pay rent, the building would collapse, to feeling like suddenly not paying rent, you have more ownership over the building than you ever have before. And so I think what this really shows us, right, is like, you know, the book is called Abolish Rent, but another way of thinking about rent abolition is a permanent and general rent strike, right? It's like when we are on rent strike, we get the brief experience of housing as a human right, like shelter without having to pay for it. And I just will mention, as Ben said, right, like tomorrow, actually, my building celebrates our second year on rent strike. And thank you. And I, like, it's been really fun. And but I do think that what, like, the thing that I've gotten to experience, right, is the kind of ownership over space that, like, the things that we had to learn about, like dealing with plumbing, like that we had to take over ourselves in the absence of our landlords, but then thinking about the kind of ownership that is collectively made and the collective control that we have that's about chipping away at landlord's power by building our own infrastructures. And I think that those are some of the experiences that we gained.
Mine is two stories that are part of one story. So, and this is also important in the construction of the organization. You know, nothing is easy, and I want to emphasize the whole idea of the role of the nonprofits in this process, and also our own contradictions about how we have to fight. When the COVID epidemic. pandemic. When the COVID pandemic came, our local had we have a small sector serving the tenants who have needs. We call it as a solidarity case work. And we work on it, all the tenants who are in crisis, and it became very, very clear that lots of tenants were not going to be able to pay rent. So the organizer who's working on that comes to us and says, guys, people cannot pay the rent. There's just not going to be possible. And basically, in the discussion we're having about what could tenants do and what should they do, and basically the logic thing was, well, they cannot pay rent. So we decided to launch a campaign saying it's the food, not rent. But at the beginning of these conversations, we were talking with different organizers, and many organizers were afraid of putting the tenants at risk. But the risk already existed. People could not pay rent. So the question was how we were going to name the crisis, how we were going to take over that crisis. And it was clear that the tenants were more advanced. They knew they were not going to pay rent. They were not going to pay rent, but the organizers were not ready for that. So we had to have a series of discussions about this. But eventually, after many discussions, a bunch of us decided to, let's just go for it. And we called the rent strike, and we called the Food Not Rent campaign, and we started what we believe was the first launching of the rent campaign, April 1st, April Fool's, by the way. And we decided to go for it, and we decided to launch the Food Not Rent campaign, which then took off nationally. But it was the tenants themselves driving the campaign, forcing the organizers to figure what the fuck to do. More recently, after that, you know, the fight has continued, the funding has recessed, there is not enough money, and we have lots of people who still cannot pay rent. Very recently, in three buildings, three properties, where mostly immigrant families are living, who are a product of other process of displacement that has happened in our community. Basically, what's happening is people who have lost their homes are moving out of their places, and they're moving into bedrooms. Whole families are moving into bedrooms. So there is these three properties with kind of Airbnbs, hotels, but basically there is like 8 rooms to a building and 1 kitchen and 2 bathrooms, and whole families are living in each one of these bedrooms. And we're talking about 60 families who are living under horrible conditions, sexual harassment, threats from the landlord, and they cannot pay rent. And the conditions are really, really bad. So the organizer comes, the tenants are telling the organizer, there's nothing we can do, we cannot pay the rent, the guy is harassing us, it's horrible, it's really bad news. And they decided to go on a rent strike. So the landlord starts threatening with eviction, it goes on. This goes on for 6 months. In the middle of the period, like a month, two, I'm like freaking out because, you know, the COVID protections are gone, there is no more money, and the tenants are still insisting on going on the rent strike. And the organizer, who happens to be my son, with another organizer, say, fuck you, we're not going to negotiate, we're going to stick to the rent strike. And, you know, I have all this experience. I'm like, look, this is the challenge. You have to talk to him, sit down with the landlord, says, fuck him, I'm not going to talk to him. And they goes to the tenant and says, hey, fuck him, we're not going to talk to him. I go to a meeting to try to convince everybody, please, you have to negotiate the landlord. We're going to be at risk. With the lawyer himself, he's telling us to do that. They said, fuck him, we're not going to do him. Mostly women, 6 months, almost a year, no, 7 months now, $500,000 later, they forced the landlord to fix the apartments and to forgive $500,000 in rent. We cannot go anymore by what's prescribed by our institutions, by what's prescribed by our organizing culture, by what's prescribed by our politics. We need to rethink this thing. We need to centralize our struggle on what the tenants are capable of doing and willing to do. We have to centralize our struggle in pushing the tenants themselves to put risk, because there is nowhere else to go. So it's very, very important to reconsider, as we talk about these things, on what we know and start thinking, what else do we know that we can take risks on? So that's just my story.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
Just, I realize I never finished the Mariachi story, which, just to say, they won a collective bargaining agreement, which is the equivalent of rent control for their building. So that, they invented, like, to think about, like, they invented rent control for themselves. And also just to name, too, like, you know, that this idea of risk is, I think, really important, you know, and in the context of, like, we're already taking a risk by not acting. Mm-hmm. Like, we're already taking a risk by not taking the risk that we could together.
I want to ask each of you a kind of your own distinct question. We'll start with Tracy, and then I'll ask a question to Leo afterwards. You know, renters for a long time have been totally absent from mainstream political culture, only mentioned disparagingly if they're mentioned at all. And yet, increasingly, questions about housing, even rent, are entering into the center of Beltway discussion. I'm thinking here of Kamala Harris's bill around national rent control. At a time when this discourse is so ubiquitous, you wrote a book that sort of reframes the question of housing policy. And I wonder if you want to talk a little about this. What are the central ideological interventions of the book? So what do you want to change about the way that we talk about the housing crisis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think, I mean, and part of it is we're being organized by the state of emergency, right? Like we're being organized by the fact that 600,000 people in the richest country in the history of the world sleep outside every night. And it takes 4 full-time minimum wage jobs to afford the average 2-bedroom. And amount of money, a new thing just happened, which is that the amount of money that you can make from owning property just exceeded for the first time the average amount of money that you can make from working, right? So this is the way that we've structured our economy. And so I think that, you know, like part of the intervention of this book is like the insight and the experience that our members have that, you know, like people describe something called the housing crisis, right? But for poor and working class people, that is a permanent crisis. You know, for us, in thinking about, you know, like what people call the housing system, right? Like if the purpose of a system is what it does, then what does our housing system do, right? Our housing system puts trillions of dollars into the hands of landlords and speculators, and it ejects people onto the streets, right? This is an unhousing system. And we wanted to name that as the crisis, right? We wanted to name rent itself as the crisis, that monthly tribute that claims our wages, and that we have to pay, right, at the peril of our need and at the barrel of a gun, right? Like we pay rent because we need housing, but also because if we don't pay rent, right, the agents of the state, because like what is an ownership deed besides a voucher for state violence, right? So like if we don't pay rent, the sheriffs or the cops can literally use physical force to throw us out of our homes because someone's right to make money is more important than our right to have housing. And not only that, right, but if we end up outside, you know, the Supreme Court just decided that cities can make it a entirely criminal offense, can fine, ticket, jail, and banish you from public space if you're a homeless person who has nowhere else to go, right? So the criminalization of homelessness also means, like, you know, we have to pay rent, not just because we need it, because it's a literal crime not to have it. And another way of putting this, right, it's like, it's a crime not to be exploited. That is the system of criminalization. So just thinking about, you know, I think this answers a little, gets into the part of your second question, right? But like thinking about how criminalization helps to support that system of exploitation and domination that we call the housing market, right? And that to me, right, is like really raises the question of the role of the state. So when we're talking about housing policy, right, like does anyone know how much time the average landlord spends maintaining their properties a month? Anyone know? You want to guess? Okay, so it's 4 hours. 4 hours a month. I think we need to ask, right? Like, how do they work 4 hours a month and get to claim so much fucking money? How, right? And the way that that happens has to do with a larger project, right? That is a project of class domination that in the book we call the war on tenants, right? So that is like the war on drugs, this is a project of creating captive classes of exploitable and disposable people. And crucially, right, like that is the work that goes into producing people that are exploitable to the degree that landlords can work 4 hours and claim, like, with the average, I think, just hit like $3,500 a month, right? And I think it's also important when we think about the war on tenants, right? Like the way that we tell the story, you know, you can't talk about housing in this country without talking about race, and you can't talk about race in this country without talking about housing. So we like really try to situate this project of the war on tenants, you know, like beginning and hoping that, like, you know, it's just a really brief overview that will bring people into this way of looking at a story which is often told from the perspective of the people that it benefits, right, which are homeowners, right? But we begin with this idea of like a white reconstruction, right? Like wealth that is built around the capture of indigenous land, and that's where we start, and we end up with a system of private homeownership that predominantly an asset-based welfare, which predominantly benefits predominantly benefits the rich and white, and then with prisons as our public housing, right? So this is the bifurcated system that we're naming as the war on tenants, that this system that produces private asset-based wealth and a public housing system of prisons, right? Where like cages are the substitute for public housing that is offered, and that those are actually the two forms of housing that the government spends the most money on. So we need to think about like prisons as our form of public housing that is used to prop up that system of private asset ownership, right? And so we end the sort of understanding of this like reframe on the war on tenants with Donald Trump and Breonna Taylor, right? A real estate developer in chief who made his fortune by exploiting development subsidies, and a black woman who was murdered by Louisville police for getting in the way of a development project. And I think just to like, you know, close, right? Like this is the crisis. Exploitation and domination of tenants is the crisis. And rather than think about, you know, a neutral, like something neutral, like housing policy, we should be thinking about the state's role in the war on tenants.
That's great. Leo, I want to ask you a question, and then we are going to, yeah. I'm going to ask Leo you a question, and then we're going to have time probably for one more lightning round question, and then I want to kick it to the Q&A afterwards. So Leo, you know, Mike Davis, who's a hero I know of all three of us, he's talked a lot about how one of the prime obstacles to class formation, to class organization in the United States, has been one of the main challenges to building a kind of common proletarian subculture are the divides between the neighborhood and the workplace, that the working class in the United States, so unlike the kind of core working class precincts of Western Europe, has been disarticulated and divided. That these two places of exploitation don't seem to relate to one another often in the United States, leaving people unstamped by an identity that in other parts of the world was maybe born of this coherent life world. In the book, you describe that project of class formation, of class organization, of giving a kind of class framework to individual housing problems as a central project of the tenant union. But sometimes it seems, and many people would kind of complain, that like this moves too slowly. The scale is too small. We're working in the ones and the twos. We're bringing together tenants building by building, and sometimes only portions of one building and then another. Others might say that's why we need to focus on legislative victories, since the law works at a more universal or certainly a higher scale. And I'm curious what you would say to that, to the challenge of scale more generally, with respect to getting people organized.
Fuck that. No, I'm kidding. No, I mean, how many, 60 million people on the gig economy, and really we're not organized around industry anymore. And the United States is completely deindustrializing. We're really in the era of financialization. There is no more to produce here. So where are all these people? They're in our neighborhoods. They're in the neighborhoods and some are better paid than others, but their housing is at risk, and the relationship to their housing is being threatened by all the things that Tracy just mentioned. So the place of organizing is the neighborhood. And to my fellow organizers, it's not building by building. We need to organize the neighborhoods. People live in buildings, and the buildings are in blocks. The blocks are in neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods are in cities, and the cities are in states. And if we don't build territory, you fight a war by creating territory, control controlling territory, managing territory. And that's what the tenants of Unión de Vecinos and the LATU are doing. Basically establishing base heads in the territory of the neighborhood, understanding what are the problems, and when there's problems with the building, they address those problems. And when there's problems in the neighborhood, they address problems. We need to build a power that transforms these situations. And maybe I'm going ahead of the part of the question. We have a committee in Boyle Heights in the corner of Wabash and Fickett, where basically you have one stoplight, one bus stop. There is the food distribution 2 blocks down from that corner. And there is an alley where there used to be gangs, gang violence. Just to give you a brief story really fast, I hope. One day this man drives into the alley because it was the back entrance to his house. And as he's getting out of the car to go in, he gets the crap beaten out of him. The tenants are organizing, trying to figure out what to do about that. And, you know, there was a problem of gang violence. What they started doing, they start cleaning up the alley. And as they clean up the alley, they start saying, oh, wow, this is a good space for us to have recreation space. So it becomes a recreation space for the community and a place for movie nights. One night, as they're preparing to show the movie, the gang members come and say, what the fuck are you doing here? This is our hood. And the woman says, well, we're just going to show a movie today for the children. Are you okay with that? I said, okay, fine, but just for tonight. As the night goes on, the guy who's from the gang member starts getting closer and closer and closer. At the end of the movie, he's sitting down with the kids watching the movie. The following week, the gang members are blocking the alley, watching the movie with them. So the alley becomes liberated and becomes a shared zone between the gang members and the community. Within that process, the community also had to cross the street to go to the school, which was like, just had to cross the street and get into the school, like one block down the street. But because of the way that traffic was organized, people had to go 3 blocks down and turn around. Well, the members of the union said, fuck this, we're going to do something different. And they start asking the council member to do this. They write a petition. The council member doesn't do anything. So what they do is start creating fake crossing guards. They put up their jackets and draw out a stop sign and start blocking traffic every time they can. Eventually, the council member is really upset because the police is complaining. They don't want to arrest the old lady blocking the street, of course. And all these people are coming. So we say, okay, fine, we're not going to do that. But we start organizing to cross hundreds of people in the street at a time. Every time we cross the street, it's 100 people crossing the street, which also blocks traffic. So finally, the council member says, okay, I'm going to work with you on this stuff. The Department of Transportation doesn't want to do it because the flow of traffic is not correct and all that stuff. And so the council member, who's sick and tired of us doing this shit, calls and says, okay, there's gonna be a monitor of the traffic crossing on such and such a day from this time to that time. You guys better cross X number of people across the street on that day so you get your stoplight. We organized the council member replied, and we did that. We got our stoplight. Then also around the same corner, there is a bus stop, and most senior citizens go to that bus stop. There is no place to sit down. We decided to build a bench and put it there. We have a phrase in the Union, más vale pedir perdón que pedir permiso. It's better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. So we put that bench. The bench still there. The stoplight is there. Our alley is safe. We have created a micro municipality within that mile square area because of the committees of tenants organizing to look at the conditions around of that. Imagine multiplying that across the city. And this is done through the everyday like organizing of tenants. This is happening because tenants decide that where they live is valuable. This goes against the myth that only homeowners care about their community. So, Mike Davis, I think you were mistaken on this one. The neighborhood is the place where workers organize. And in this current, actually, there was a mistake. It was a different economic moment. This economic moment pushes us into our house because of the gig economy, because of the industrialization, etc., and so forth. This movement also puts us closer to the struggle for land. The struggle for territory is the struggle for the space where we build our homes, where we play, where we work, where we do whatever we want. This is a struggle to control the city, take it over, and take it away from the capitalists.
All right.
Yeah. One more thing. Imagine this power building a national rent control. Imagine this power creating an anti-eviction law. Imagine this power declaring the expropriation of land that is not being used. Imagine this power saying a landlord can only own so many properties. Imagine this power building and socializing housing for 5 million people. This is the kind of stuff that an organized, mobilized movement can do to provide the housing that they do. This is what the tenant rights movement is doing in Venezuela, by the way.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.